perfume is the message. Money makes a dance. Love is the product. The joke is in. The joke is in. The joke is in your face.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show. The Left Behind series is a series of novels about an upcoming apocalypse in which Christians get raptured up and everybody else gets royally screwed. It's sold over 60 million copies. Novelist and cyberpunk legend John Shirley's latest book, The Other End, is an alternative rapture story. And if he sells just 10% as many books as those other guys did, he's promised to buy us all ice cream cones. So we'll be talking to John Shirley later in the show. But first, we are here with Jeff Deal, Steve Robles, and Diana Brown.
Hello. Well, it's been a little while since I've enjoyed all your company. I have to say, I have been keeping up with your activities, Are You, on Tenzin Monkeys. And recently you proposed, I think, an important question. You sent it out to various people. The question you proposed was, do we live in a fascist state? Why or why not? And you got some really amazing responses back.
And I got some amazing non-responses.
And you got some amazing non-responses back. And some of which you printed? No, I'm
kidding. A lot of unamazing responses.
And a lot of similar responses. One of the things that kept coming up was we need another word for it, that we're not living in a fascist state, but we need a new word to describe the world we're living in right now.
A militarized plutocracy.
Corporate republic.
Very close to what a lot of people have to say.
Everybody's coming up with something. I got to come up with something.
All right, Are You?
Highly marinated beefsteak.
I'm going to call us the Made for TV World.
Another great band name.
Can you get that at an Outback Steakhouse? I wonder. I'd
order it along with your dictatorship.
Ooh.
Coming soon.
Do they sell dictators now in small, you know, family-sized bags?
Mashed dictators.
Which someone brought up, the real quote-unquote dictator or leader of this country is actually Cheney, not
Cheney,
Bush.
Yeah. That was the fuck you Dick Cheney
that
guy.
That was the fuck you Dick Cheney guy.
Yeah.
Tell us about talking to him. I bet that was fascinating.
Yeah, how did you find him?
Well, when he did his fuck you Dick Cheney thing, I thought it would be great to get him on the phone for a couple of minutes for one of these shows immediately afterwards and interview him. But it took him a couple of months to respond to my email.
After getting pummeled by the Secret Service.
His time is Guantanamo.
Well, he's gathered a following for having...
Yeah, imagine that.
He's a pretty interesting guy. He's a doctor, a punk rock musician, and a writer, and his name is Ben Marble.
Ben
MD.
Marble, yes, right.
And he has a great name for the followers of as he calls him, W. Gump, because he spells out very clearly that the USA is now ruled by a dictator, and his name is Dictator Cheney. But his name for the followers of Bush is Bush Sheep. I thought that was brilliant.
Bush Sheep, yeah. Well, that was the closest thing to a total rant in all of the contributions. Most of them were measured.
Yeah, including entire sentences in all caps that I had to edit. I'm sorry. I won't do that to my readers. I won't.
Important.
He nails it down that we have a duopoly. On the right, the pseudo-Christian Bush Sheep minority, and on the Democratic side is the PC utopian fascist minority.
Now, that was peculiar, because it sounds, you start off thinking that he's coming from a very far left place.
Exactly.
And then you kind of don't know where at all. And he does this, like, really extreme rant and then calls for a kind of moderate centrist politics.
Which is not what we expect.
It's totally unexpected, which is... a sign of either insanity or excellent writing. And you'll have to be the judge by going to tenzenmonkeys.com and reading what he has to say.
So what do you have anything you'd say on the quote-unquote fascist left? I mean, a lot of people have brought that up as that we now have an utterly fascist left. And, you know, we bandy the term around and giggle about it sometimes. But what do you guys think about that?
Fascist left?
Do you think there was a fascist left?
Well, I think it's the least of our worries at the moment.
Yeah, I think the fascist right is the more compelling one. But,
yeah.
Again, though, I mean, whoever's talking about needing a new term, you know, what the fuck are we talking about when we say fascist? We're basically talking about authoritarian, right? We're talking about leaders who use too much of their power to...
No, it's actually addresses something very specific, and this is what I didn't understand. There was a guy very recently on the Are You Serious show talking about, I think it was Are You Serious or Neophiles, talking about how people bandy this fucking term about.
And he was part of the discussion, actually.
I saw his post, and I agreed with the guys that thought, and I don't understand how you actually subscribe to this, because...
Subscribe to what?
The whole idea that we live in a fascist state.
I never said that I subscribe to it in the least.
I think the fact...
I wrote an ironic introduction.
Did you?
Did you read it?
I did. The irony escaped me. I thought that the introduction of the subject itself implied that it was...
No, he's just saying that a lot of people are using this term. And,
you know, it's funny because
I had to read through like four or five different things before I found somebody that actually disagreed with the premise.
Which question should we address first?
We asked a bunch of different people and they had a bunch of different opinions.
A bunch of assholes that had the same fucking opinion all over again. It's like, of course we live in a fascist state because Bush sucks.
The majority of them said that we didn't.
No, I don't think so.
You're a careless reader.
I guess so. I was overwhere. Overwhelmed by how many people said,
There were a few that said we did.
I went through like four or five before I found somebody that said, no, we don't.
Well, you can make the argument, but the argument rests on definition, and I think even our friend who is an expert in fascism agrees that the definitions of fascism are pretty nebulous. Actually, Pat Buchanan was talking about the neoconservatives talking about Islamic fascism on TV. I saw him and he said, you know, nobody really knows what fascism is. And Buchanan ought to know.
It's a very difficult ideology to pin down. The one guy on there that said that there needs to be a military component to it, an active military component, and this is where
this just doesn't happen
in this administration.
Cares? Who the fuck cares? Why are we even bothering with this word? I mean, there are other better ways to describe what's going on. And, you know, people can pretty much agree that it's fucked up in the sense that
there are levels of fucked upness, man.
Why do we need to worry about the word fascist, though?
Well, that was the question Are You posed at the beginning of the article. You know, he started this out. I know you're here, but I mean, I'm pointing out that...
Speak for me.
Let me speak for you, Are You?
Fascist.
I speak over you so often. Let me speak for you. So you asked this really prudent question, which is, you said was in the back of your mind, the auxiliary question is, does it matter? In other words, certain levels of repression and intolerance are being manifested in various public, political, and legal spheres. We can legitimately label it all fascism. Will that help to generate a successful opposition?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. And people sometimes say, oh, well, it's fascist, so therefore what? Therefore,
we can argue about what it means to be fascist.
Therefore, I'm going to hide. Therefore what? I'm going to move to Canada.
Right.
Therefore what?
Well, you brought up the Bush equals Hitler protest signs.
I hate those assholes.
You asked you know, a lot of people are right there with you, Steve. Are you asked the question, how do they think that's helping? Do they think somebody walking down the street who is sort of neutral is going to see this sign and go, oh, Bush equals Hitler? Why didn't you say so? Let me run out and do something.
This is the troubling thing about living in a progressive culture, a self-enclosed progressive
left culture
in San Francisco, is that you get this kind of intellectual inbreeding, And, like, you get these fucking kids that come down from Arcata. They're all fucking hairy and asking for change and shit. And they haven't thought this shit out. They absorb it and they swallow it up and they spit it out just the same way some fucking idiot kid in Iowa that drives a big fucking truck.
Didn't we all do the same thing when we were 20? I did. I don't know.
I tried to have some fucking thought behind my bullshit at 20. Even at 20, you know?
Well, you're pointing out...
What the hell happened to you?
Yeah, I know. It doesn't happen now that I'm almost 40.
Well, Steve, you're kind of pointing out what Ken Lane had to say at when RU interviewed him. Was that an interesting interaction with Ken Lane? He said, you know, there's humorless liberals yelling fascist at anything they don't like, NASCAR, Walmart, or especially someone enjoying a nice hamburger.
Look, in the early 70s, you were a fascist if you had a job among people I was hanging out with.
And over 30.
What? You're going to get dressed up and go into work 9 to 5? Fucking
that's right,
Nazi?
Suit. Nazi suit. That's right.
See, and this is my whole thing is like, this was, compare, I mean, what's funny is we've compared... ended up comparing Nixon and Bush, and in a lot of ways, policy-wise, Nixon ends up looking pretty reasonable. But
except for they got a couple of million people killed in Southeast Asia.
This is what I'm talking about, and this is why Nixon was actually closer to fascist than Bush, because they had this shit going on in the street, man. You had Jackson State and Kent State and all that shit. You had Reagan pummeling fucking students. That was way more of a fascist state than so these old hippies that fucking...
You don't even know what's going on now. Now, though, the shit that's going on right now that's top secret,
I can
nobody
guarantee
knows about.
You
we
that don't fucking know. You can have a protest at a university in this fucking country without getting shot in the fucking
can
throat.
You? Can you really? You have to get a fucking permit to do a parade, and that's what people do now, parade.
Are you going
to
get shot in the throat if you don't have a fucking permit?
If you do a real protest, yeah.
Now we're getting into it. I think if you started having the kind of militancy you had in the 1970s...
Fuck yeah, that was a real threat of violence behind it.
You'd see people, lots of people getting shot.
Probably a much more likelihood of a boot to the head than a parade.
The worst now is a bunch of fucking hippies, you know, tying their hands together and then getting thrown in the back of a paddy wagon. They don't have the balls to do anything else.
Okay,
why? Because, you know, you're gonna get
still,
shot if you do.
And they're still have Quakers, you know, anti-war Quakers listed with the Homeland Security Department.
I think that is amazing to me. That and the fact that in before 2008 they talk about we're all going to have a little chip in our ID. That freaks me out.
I don't know. There's this whole thing. There's the whole thing about, like, you can sign up for this program that, like, is supposed to expedite your fucking airport experience. And what's funny is I read about it, and the steps, you have to take like 20 steps to qualify for the program. It takes like 10 times as long as, you know, if they just let the dog sniff your butt crack. You know, it's no
just once.
Like,
you just apply once. You go through all that once, and then you can.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna fly a lot, then you know, might be worth it.
Now, this term friendly fascism keeps popping up. Do you want to elaborate on that? I'm a little off the radar on friendly fascism.
Boy, it was a book written a long time ago. It was basically about the corporatism, and if I remember correctly, the idea was that although you can dissent is ineffective, and therefore it amounts to something like fascism.
Okay. This would go along the lines of our president's, what are they called, signing measures. He just... makes signing statements. He just decides, I'm going to go ahead and take it.
But dictatorship is different from fascism. And fascism has a whole bunch of qualities. And I think that the militarization of an entire society and the idea of having a pretty highly disciplined society is an aspect of fascism that people don't really talk about.
Although, is it necessarily limited to like the entire society? Because aside from the official military, right now, I mean, I'm reading this book called License to Kill, which is about all of these, like, you know, freelance paramilitary groups that have been used since 9/11 to go after Bin Laden over in Iraq. They opened up this huge market. The Blackwater Security Company and shit.
And they
like
do
that.
Whatever they want. They run around.
They're
with
not
guns.
In the military. They're like ex CIA people, and these are bad motherfuckers. And they work for their own gain. They work for real money. They're like mercenaries, only they're jacked up with all sorts of weapons. And tell me that in, you know, within the next few years, if not now, that there aren't independent group networks of these people taking leaders out, taking, you know, doing shit that we don't even know, maybe based on their own ideas of politics, or maybe in conjunction with, say, Dick Cheney, which would be a fascist state by most definitions. You have this like paramilitary.
So you're talking
aspect.
About them coming back here and using those tactics.
Yeah,
but I mean, Michael Lerner, who answered the question, I think made a great point in the sense that it's not fascism here, but we got to look globally. At what we do globally. Anybody want to end with a joke?
This is almost too seriously to be joked about.
That's right.
No, then nothing's too seriously to be joked about.
That's what we're counting on you for, Steve.
well, you guys have made me go all serious.
Never come on. Somebody come up with something.
All right, this will definitely send you toward a joke, Steve. I have no doubt. One gentleman, and let me get the source of this first, points out that part of the whole fascist mindset, we can see signs of this. These infernal regions also need to be seen within the context of the explosion of heterosexual and homosexual BDSM pornography all over the world. And he invokes the line from the film Hitler, and apparently it's a
very long.
It's a musical, right?
It's a happy film. Hitler, oh. Here is your victory, and so he really calls that. This gentleman calls that we note that as a rise of fascism all over the world, but certainly largely. Coming
You're saying
out
the academics
America.
Shouldn't be afraid to cite pornography on the internet as
Scott
support
J. Thompson.
For.
Like, yeah, he really cites
as an example
well,
of fascist tendencies. Actually.
Exactly, BDSM that, pornography, gay and straight, as what, an example.
What's happening to our erotic? Sensibility is the underlying violence of it, and so.
But also, you think of it. I mean, we know that the Weimar culture, for instance, had a pretty healthy kind of dominant early stage domination thing going on before the rise of right. fascism.
And there are two ways of looking at it. So, one of our guests really saw that as sort of a resistance towards fascism, people being able to practice any kind of sexuality that they want. And whereas Scott Thompson, I'm remembering his name, is sort of suggesting that it's indicative of a kind of psychological fascism that we might connect to Wilhelm Reich's idea of sexual repression and so forth.
Well, if you look at the most, the most cited fascist regime, the Nazis, there's a real weird mix-up going on. That's a different kind of fascism.
Not the who's down in Whoville.
Yeah.
But Daltrey, I think, played for the Nazis for
yes,
a while,
I think
didn't
so.
He?
Oh, yeah.
We're here with John Shirley. John Shirley's novels include the seminal cyberpunk works City Comes a-Walkin', the trilogy Eclipse, Eclipse Penumbra, and Eclipse Corona. He also wrote the script for the popular film The Crow, and he's written for screen and television, including work on the great Max Headroom series. As a musician, Shirley has fronted his own bands and written lyrics for the Blue Oyster Cult and others. Today we'll be talking mostly about his new novel, The Other End, which I understand will be available probably towards the end of this month or early in January. And welcome, John.
Thanks.
So this book, The Other End, is pretty much a response to the very popular Left Behind series. And did you actually read it?
I read At It, and I read interviews with the people, and I saw interviews with them, and I'm aware of their trip. It is, right. as they say, a trip, I felt that it should not go unanswered, that their trip should not be superimposed over the world's imagination. I mean, if people are going to imagine a judgment day or an apocalypse, right. and the word apocalypse just means an unveiling or a revealing, anyway.
Right.
If they're going to imagine this transformative stage, then let's imagine one, that's an alternative to the extreme right-wing anti-life kind of a vision of the Left Behind authors. I mean, these guys are primitive thinkers, and they're superimposing a medieval worldview on millions of Americans. I mean, these books are popular. The Left Behind books are popular.
They're usually popular. I know it's like 60 million sold.
Yeah,
like,
60 million, and there are TV movie versions, and there are plans for more.
How many actual novels are there?
I have lost track because they spun it out over, you know, they're numerous. Especially when they noticed that they were selling well, they found reasons to really flesh out the cycle. As long as Tim LaHaye and his friends are making
more
money.
Well, that's a good thing then, right?
As long as they keep on needing to write books.
Then we're safe.
Then their followers can't be raptured up because... Yeah. But I think they're selling 6 million books and only 144,000 people can get raptured. So
I know. It must be depressing.
Some of their fans are going to be left behind.
The literal reading of Revelation is that something like 144,000 people are saved.
Really?
Yeah. But in fact, of course, as I point out in the novel, The Other End, the book of Revelation, as even the Catholic Encyclopedia acknowledges, just as one example of biblical scholarship that acknowledges it, and even Christian scholarship that acknowledges it, the book of Revelation is really just all about the Roman Empire of the time.
Sure.
The early years after Christ, the early centuries after Christ, and it was a sort of protest against the persecution of Christians, and it's sort of means with which the writer could inflame people with hope when they felt, you know, despair because of this persecution.
Right, so people who were writing were responding to the environment around them. They weren't playing Nostradamus or anything
like that. They were kind of making short-term predictions, but nothing, you know, that would apply to our age. And the analysis of the Book of Revelations that scholars make is completely different from that of the Left Behind authors and people like them. I mean,
so I'm confused. I thought the Bible was written by God.
Well, I think the theory is that
a good Stephen Colbert kind of question.
I think the theory is that that it's transmitted through people from God. People are very poor filters, though, of information from the divine, if there is any that's being translated into sacred texts.
It is kind of funny because it's called the Book of Revelation. Like, if God wrote it, then he's having a revelation of himself.
He's revealing
his plan for seven-headed crowned dragons.
That is correct.
Right.
That is correct. And for the beast and for the Whore of Babylon, he worked all that out and decided that we needed the Whore of Babylon to straighten our asses out.
Well, I
needed her to straighten my ass.
Exactly.
Asses out.
I think it was the Lord doing, you know, shock cinema as early as, you know, doing Pulp Fiction. Really,
it's kind of a John Waters effort.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Whore of Babylon. Come on, that's so over the top. How literal is this series, and then how literal is your response to it in terms of translation from these rather archaic symbologies from the Book of Revelation?
Well, they're trying to be as literal minded as they can. They have a whole point of view on the Bible that is literal minded, and. And you know, you can point to the fact that if you're going to be literal minded, then we're the product of incense because Adam and Eve's children had to have married one another. For example,
yeah,
it's
that
famous.
Gets a little sticky.
In Sodom and Gomorrah, the cat who fled with his family had sex with his daughters afterward. And he's supposed to be an example
upright.
Of righteousness. And so, you know, I suppose they probably have excuses for those things.
Well, people down south don't really have a problem with that.
Tim LaHaye is from Texas.
I get in trouble with some of my listeners.
I never thought
listeners
of that. Tim LaHaye is from Texas, and it's kind of conventional there, isn't it? Well, see, yeah, they're literal-minded about it. And it really gets you into trouble. I have written The Other End as an alternative apocalypse, and it is cunningly written so as to be not dogmatic in a thousand ways, and open to quite a bit of interpretation. But, you know, I'm also very definite about some things I always wanted to see happen. You know, some injustices redressed, a certain, you know, if you could make up your own apocalypse, and if you could decide what would be your judgment day, you know, what would you do? You would probably have a distinctive one, and mine is somewhat distinctive to me, but I think it's of things that a lot of people dream about. They originally, the novel was going to be called A Wistful Dream, which is kind of a limp title, so I couldn't use that, but that's what it is. It's like a dream where I wistfully imagine if I could be in control and sweep through the world and make all these vast changes, and what would I do? And so it just kind of posits another point of view. In a way, it's another paradigm, sort of for what change would be like. And so it's a fantasy that offers this other paradigm that's an alternative to the right-wing mind control paradigm of people like Tim LaHaye.
And you talk about it in the book as an epidemic of justice. And basically what I see in the book is suddenly certain numbers of people, large numbers of people, can no longer do horrible things to other people. And some people might immediately translate that in personal terms, but in your book it's very much in political terms.
Well, it happens... It like pressure points around the world that there's this sort of manifestation, which is this kind of incandescent appearance of two infinite cones touching at their infinitely refined points. And out of these infinitely refined points, which people who have taken acid will recognize, they'll say, "Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that. I saw those." From those emanates a wave of pure consciousness and kind of a ripple of awakening quality. It's hard to describe extemporaneously, but it's just people who were sort of trapped in their, you know, in the little mazes of their subjectivity suddenly become objective. And they see how they are making other people suffer, and they see how that makes them suffer more, and they suddenly become empathetic. And are able to feel other people suffering.
Or something.
A kind of universal Satori within that area and that pressure point. And then they, people who were gangbangers on the one hand, or on the other hand, brutal cops, or right-wing Christians on one hand, or fundamentalist Muslim bombers on the other, suddenly become empathetic and suddenly see objectively and suddenly see where they were delusional because they were trapped in this subjectivity. And I don't exactly lay out a sort of alternative objective reality for people to conform to because, you know, I mean, that would be like Ayn Rand or something dreadful like that. But it is based on more consciousness and more empathy. And so that is an apocalyptic thing, in a sense. If you have a wave of consciousness and empathy rippling out over the world, that would be apocalyptic. That would be a kind of judgment day. It would be an alternative judgment day. And that's actually the first stage of it. And there are other stages that get sort of more radical.
Right. And by implication, I mean, it would just wreck the economy for...
Yeah, because people start... Well, sort of, maybe. Although people are also aware that this is a first stage. When they experience right. this, they get a sense that this is all going to be very temporary and everything's going to be reorganized very soon.
Right.
And I don't want to exactly give away how that happens, but at the end of the book, you find out how that happens. You know, also, a lot of times we find out that giving is actually something that lubricates... a healthy economy,
right?
You know,
right. But I mean, you do have like, without giving away too much, you have some corporate people who suddenly can't continue to operate in the ways that they've been operating. And
yeah, there's a guy who's the head of a major energy concern, and he used to be having meetings with Cheney and secret meetings with Cheney, for example, and he experiences one of these consciousness-raising encounters with this sort of interpenetration from a higher realm. And he dissolves his company. It's a little bit like you can't take it with you, the copper thing. You know, it is very Capra-esque, I must admit. I've been watching some Capra.
It's Capra. Very emotionally satisfying. It's really emotionally satisfying.
Like Capra, it is. But I kind of take it into a sort of Aldous Huxleyan perennial philosophy kind of vibe instead of just the sort of social awareness that Capra had going on, but it's something, a similar kind of feeling. And it does try to strike those emotional resonances where people feel some satisfaction with the kind of a moral compass swinging around.
Right, and some people wake up, and also some people sort of get theirs, get justice is delivered.
Yeah, there are some people that who are so damaged or so kind of made badly from the start that they are kind of compassionately turned off. And after I wrote it, I thought, you know what that reminds me of is Stranger in a Strange Land, which is probably another predecessor for this, when he would just sort of unexist people in that book. And that kind of happens in this book. They get sort of painlessly switched off, some people like psycho killers, for example, and Rumsfeld, a few other people of this variety who are just beyond the pale and hopeless, but people who just can't resist the raise in consciousness so actively that it can't penetrate, and or they're so damaged that they can't. Because you have to be realistic about the world, but I'm very fair about who it happens to. It doesn't happen to every right-wing Christian, for example. Lots of them go into the next stage, and it doesn't happen that all lefties are spared, for example, and so on.
Right.
So it's kind of, it's a wonderful apocalypse.
That's true.
Beautiful.
Very true.
This sounds to me like a good spot to pause and listen to a Panther Moderns tune. Can you describe what we're going to listen to?
It's something I wrote in collaboration with Mr. Johnny Carr, who's a San Francisco composer and sound engineer and producer, guitarist. He's been working with the Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum lately, doing all their sound and production. I did the lyrics and vocals, and it's kind of a commentary. It does fit with the other end, actually, thematically, because it's a commentary about how flawed existence is in this world, and that what is it that makes it tolerable? Just one, and the relationships we have make it tolerable, and I just take it to extremes and how flawed this world is, because that's what the other end is partly about. It is also an existential protest. It isn't like just a jolly, if everybody gets together and loves one another, we'll all be fine sort of story. It isn't. It's about how...
It shines a light in many
screwed
ways.
Screwed up, profoundly screwed up the world is, and I try to shine a light on some of the darkest corners. I talk about people selling their own children to, which is epidemic in some parts of the world.
All right, well, let's hear it and come
You're
right back.
The reason.
A New York apartment without heat. The world is LA traffic. The world's a Chicago train. You never will outlast it. The world takes your name in vain. Casting director,
natural world is in my face. My set is not erector, and we're soon gone without a trace. World's a Vegematic, it's slicing, dicing all our plans. The world is automatic, it's software, it's pure chance.
Buried in the Sky, out in the current revived Weird Tales magazine. Just a selection from the novella. At first, it was like any mall anywhere. Although it was so high up in the skyscraper, they felt a little tired and lightheaded. Deed heard a security guard talking about it to the man who ran the frozen yogurt shop. The young black guard had a peculiar uniform, dark gray, almost black, with silver epaulettes and the shapes of snakes going around his cuffs. "Yeah, man, we're so high up, the air is a little thin. They try to equalize it, but it don't always go. They're working out the bugs, like that groaning in the elevators." Windows at the end of the mall's long corridor showed the hazy, dull blue sky and planes going by, not that far above, and the tops of high buildings. Seeing just the tops from here made them look to Deed like images she'd seen of buildings in Egypt and other ancient places. There are only a few other customers. They were among the first to move into the building, and the mall wasn't officially open to the public except for the apartment owners. Walking along the empty walkway between rows of glassy storefronts, Deed felt like a burglar. She had to look close to see the shopkeepers inside. The ones who noticed them looked at Deed and her siblings almost plaintively, like, "Please get me some business so I feel like this new investment isn't hopeless and doomed to failure." "Sorry, mister," she muttered. "I don't want to buy any official NFL logo gym bags." "What?" her sister Jean said. "Lenny," she's mumbling to herself again. Lenny sniggered. That's our deed. Hey, hey, what's that thing? He pointed at a window containing a rack of objects resembling bicycle helmets crossed with sea urchins. The transparent spikes on the helmets seemed to feel them looking and reacted, retracting. Ew, Gene said. It's like critter antenna things. The store was called Interactives Incorporated. There was a man in the back in a green jumpsuit, a man shaped roughly like a bowling pin, who seemed to have a bright orange face. It must be some kind of colored light back there, Dee decided, making his face look orange. The man turned to look at them, and his eyes were green. Even the parts that should be whites were green. Is that guy wearing a mask? Gene asked. The man looked at her, and a rictus-like grin jerked across his face, split it in half, and was gone. From expressionless to grin to expressionless in half a second. Deed backed away and turned hastily to the next door. That guy was all, Jean murmured, but she didn't say anything more about it. Oh, you got weird impressions sometimes in strange places, Deed decided. That's all it was. The next shop was a Nike store. Then came a Disney store, closed, and then a store called Blender. Jean stopped interested. It seemed to sell things to eat. Behind the window glass, transparent chutes curved down into blenders. Dropping through the chutes into the intermittently grinding blenders came indeterminate pieces of organic material Deed had never seen before, bits and pieces of things. They weren't definitely flesh, and they weren't recognizably fruit, but they made you think of flesh and fruit, only the colors were all wrong, the surface textures alien. Some of them seemed to be parts of brightly colored faces, which seemed to squirm in the blender so that the apparent eye would line up properly with a nose above lips, the disjointed face looking at her for a moment before being whirred away into bits. But the parts of the faces, when she looked closer, weren't noses or eyes or lips at all. What is that stuff? Deed asked. Lenny and Jean shook their heads at once, staring in puzzlement, and the blenders started whirring all at once, making the kids jump a bit. In the back of the store was a counter, and someone was on the other side of the counter, which was only about 4.5 feet high, but you could just see the top of the head on the other side of the counter, a lemon-colored head. The top of the head moved nervously back and forth. Some kid back there, Jean said, walking back and forth. Or some dwarf, Lenny said. You want to go in and see? But he didn't move toward the shop. The other two shook their heads. They moved on, passing an ordinary shop that sold fancy color photo portraits, a store that sold clothing for teenage girls that neither Jean nor Deed would be interested in. It was for cheerleader types. And then a store. Well, it was filled with bird cages, and in the cages were birds that didn't seem to have any eyes, and they seemed to have beaks covered with fur from which issued spiral tongues. They moved around in their crowded cages so fast it was hard to tell if the impression Deed had of their appearance was right. A woman in the back of the shop had a fantastic piled-up hairstyle, an elaborate coif with little spheres woven into it, reminding Deed of eyes randomly arranged in the high hairdo. The woman turned around. She must have turned all the way around really quickly, so quickly they didn't see the turn because they saw only the elaborate coif in the back of her head again. This place is making me feel ill, all sick to my stomach. Well, I guess that's enough.
So, how do you sort of combine science fiction and horror, and you find it easy to cross over between genres? Also, you write very moral fiction quite a bit. And how does that relate to the horror genre, or does it?
I think of myself as being sui generis and just sort of standing, you know, outside the horror genre and outside the science fiction genre, and then I reach in through the window, you know, when they leave it open, and I steal something from this house and something from that, and then I combine them. And to me, I'm a kind of rational surrealist, which I know is completely uncool to say, because if you know anything about surrealism, it's not supposed to be rational.
Right.
But I don't care. I break the rules. And there are, you know, if you look at something like the painter Tanguy, for example, it is actually organized in a way. It's internally logical painting. Or Max Ernst, for example, it has an internal logic of its of its own. And what I write is sort of surrealism with an internal logic, and maybe a little bit more of a moral center.
But yeah, I mean, you can use the irrational and the visionary in order to make a point in some sense, or to, or
yeah,
to make narrative sense of a world.
Yeah, yeah. And I try not to to be tedious about making any kind of moral point. I mean, right. I try to make it as so much a part of the storytelling and the entertainment that, yeah, you know, you hardly notice it's happening, hopefully. In this little piece I just read, people are moving into a new high-rise mall that it's a little bit, you know, we're all the products of our previous input, and I was referencing other people that my stuff resonates with, Huxley and Capra, and J.G. Ballard.
Yeah.
In fact, he had a book called High Rise.
That's right.
And this is much more involved with the supernatural and interpenetration of other dimensions. But it's really about somebody trying to find a kind of a moral center in themselves to relate to a chaotic, nightmarish world. And it's about our world. You see, you notice that I put these weird shops in the story right next to the Disney shops and right next to the NFL shops and so on. And many of us have the feeling when we're in a mall that we're in a place that is not very human, ultimately, and we feel alienated from it, and it seems almost as bizarre to us to look into a Disney shop as it would be to these kids to look into the shop of you know, surreal events going on.
I know whenever I'm shopping at the local Safeway, I'm always imagining that something really weird happens to keep myself interested. Like,
yeah,
you'll look over and I think Rudy Rucker once described cyberpunk as being like you're walking in a shopping mall and everything seems normal, except you notice that roboticized rats are eating at the edges of people's brains or something.
But
then
life is beginning to resemble that. There are giant rats overrunning Florida now, you know. There are. And there are, you know, the world is becoming a science fictional story, you know, realized. I mean, the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Perfect Mind.
A Spotless Mind. Yeah.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Yeah. It's a very cool movie, which I think is borrowed from a Jack Vance story called To Live Forever. That is coming true. There are pills that you can get now that actually do erase memories specifically in some way. And it's really interesting to try and figure out how you know, what's the morality, what's the ethics of that, even for your own personal use.
Right.
I mean, there are some bad memories I have that I would love to get rid of, and things that were done to me and things that I did.
Right.
But I learned something from every one of them. So I'm afraid that if I erase the memory, I also erase the moral lesson, or would I? I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
well, I read your book on Gurdjieff, and it seems like from that perspective, you wouldn't want to erase any memories.
Yeah. Well,
you?
Yeah. From the Gurdjieff point of view, G.I. Gurdjieff, or Gurdjieff, depending on who you are, and you can pronounce it either way. You're supposed to suffer whatever comes along consciously.
Right.
And
a lot of that seems to be in the other end, actually.
It's in the other end. But also, I was also informed by people like Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts,
right,
you know, and D.T. Suzuki, you know, the Zen thinkers. And they're all about conscious suffering in a way, about, you know, Aldous Huxley took acid on the day that he died in order to die consciously.
Right.
That was,
right.
I don't know if that works. I gave up acid years ago because it was making me nutty, but, you know, now I'm all better. But, it's kind of the concept in a way, but although somebody in the Gurdjieff work or in Zen would try to do it with some form of meditation, you would just try to, you know, whatever arises, you take it as part of the context of life and the movement of life and the flux and the fluctuation, and almost like you're watching a movie of your life, but with a little more involvement.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the scenes in The Other End feel like the peak, perhaps, of somebody's psychedelic experience, particularly with a strong psychedelic, like, you know, maybe like Ibogaine or something like that, where they just look at their life and say, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And the problem being, most people take psychedelics, a few weeks later. It's kind of,
Yeah, I think it was Ram Dass. Was it Ram Dass who said, with something like acid, if you take it and you get some value out of it, that's like we talked about this before, but it's like getting a phone call from someone in business, and once you've got the phone call and you got the information, you should hang up.
Yeah,
you shouldn't keep staying on that line all the time.
when you get the message, hang up the phone. But then sometimes you forget, and so maybe it could be some value yet to be had there. There are a lot of stories other than yours and other than the Other End people. There are a lot of end time stories floating around. Have you followed any of the other end time mythologies? There's the big
novels?
Mayan thing.
That always
2012.
Yeah.
I guess Mel Gibson has a movie coming out, of all people.
But I don't think it refers to our own future. I think it's about, it's all set.
Well, all the people that believe in it think the Mayan calendar predicted the apocalypse in 2012.
What I've read is that the Mayan calendar simply ends at 2012, just because you wouldn't. That they figured that was far enough in the future, and you've got to chisel the thing. You got to chisel it. You got to stop somewhere. It's not like they can make it on a computer. So
wouldn't that be something that after all that bears out that that's just where they ended, because their civilization ended before they could get to 2013.
I know they were writing it out.
Yes, they were like
who's that guy who wrote the novel and he died in the middle of it? Oh, God, I can't think of his name.
They find this tablet, it's just like 23rd.
Falter expired.
That's where it ended.
Yeah, I don't take very seriously the kind of Hollywood interpretation of mysticism and of the New Age interpretation of pre-Columbian cultures. They forget that Gibson, I think, is covering that aspect, but they forget that these people were heavily involved in human sacrifice. And how wise could you be if you think that, chopping out the heart of a little boy on a piece of rock is going to affect how the weather comes for your harvest or something? If you think that, then, you're still a primitive person. I don't care how well you build your temples. That is still primitive thinking, in my opinion. Anything that I think it's a mistake to turn to people like that.
Well, it's just like the believing in Bible prophecy, and you have to remember that these are people that used to think that you could sail off the edge of the earth.
That's true. That's true.
Why are you going to take their word for it?
That's true. You kind of have to upgrade your sources of information, and the Bible doesn't do that. They make a point of not doing that. There's much wisdom in the Bible, and there's much wisdom in the New Testament, and there's evidence to suppose that Jesus didn't say everything attributed to him in the New Testament. Some things and other things were superimposed by people who were trying to forward their own agendas. There's good biblical scholarship evidence for that, and he wasn't trying to start a religion. He was trying to just improve Judaism a bit in his mind.
Illuminate people around him.
I just heard a biblical scholar say that St. Paul never stopped being a Jew. Never wanted to be anything but a Jew.
No.
He just considered it the fulfillment of Judaism. And therefore, people who are believers in Paulism, as it's called, and St. Paul's interpretation of things, are actually Jews. So, a lot of these Christians are actually Jews, and Catholics are
they're going to have a hard time.
Catholics are
that.
Actually Jews.
They're going to have a real hard time with that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being a Jew. It's a fine thing to be. I'm not one, but I've was married to a couple of Jews. I think it was sequentially, they're good people. So they should just they're funnier than Catholics as we know them. So really,
that's where all the humor comes from. Well, speaking of Jews, how did you get involved with a nice guy like you get involved with writing lyrics for the Blue Oyster Cult?
Yeah, all the guys in that band are Jewish, I think.
And of course, Sandy Pearlman, the inventor.
And the irony is they were accused of anti-Semitism at one point. Right. Because the Blue Oyster Cult symbol.
Well, any good Jew should be accused of that at some point.
That's the way it works.
Maybe you're not doing your job as a Jew, especially now with what Israel's been pulling. If you're not accused of it by being a little bit critical, the Blue Oyster Cult. I wrote their most recent two albums. Not every song, but most of the songs on the most recent two albums. I unfortunately didn't write "Don't Fear the Reaper."
That would set you up for a while. Did Sandy write the lyrics to that?
Or did you play the cowbell?
No, I didn't play. I would have said enough cowbell, but that's just me.
Pull it back a little bit.
But the albums are called Heaven Forbid and Curse of the Hidden Mirror. I think Heaven Forbid is a very strong album itself. So you can get them from iTunes for like 99 cents a song. So.
Really, I have to check them out. Thing. I mean, a lot of people have sort of lost track of the cult since.
They still tour a lot. They, as they say, they're on tour forever. They have T-shirts that say "On Tour Forever," mm-hmm. and they play in San Francisco at Slim's every year.
Yeah.
And they're the kind of thinking man's hard rock band or power pop band sometimes. And they have lyrics by people like Jim Carroll, for example, and Michael Moorcock and Patti Smith.
Yeah.
And so they have some great lyrics.
They also have a very individual tack. You say hard rock, and people sometimes call them heavy metal. There's something very almost New York theatrical.
That's right.
About them, that kind of separates them from.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they could never be mixed up with the Spinal Tap sort of guys because they don't take it that seriously in a certain way. I mean, they like to rock, but they don't. But they're not self-serious about it. You know, they're not playing little tin gods. You know,
any band that's capable of writing. Joan Crawford has risen from the grave.
Right. That's a really funny song, Joan Crawford has risen from the grave. It's literally what it's about. It is a scary concept.
I like the line of policemen are, hiding behind the skirts of little girls. Joan Crawford.
Yeah, that is good.
Are you doing anything in terms of TV scripts these days? I know you
little bit.
Yeah, what shows... Did you
well,
work on VR? That VR.
I was story editor that, in VR 5, which is sort
that
of
that one
a,
died pretty.
It died, quickly. Yeah. They wouldn't take my advice. That's my opinion as to why. But these things are subjective, as we've already noted. But I worked on VR 5 for Fox, and more recently, I've been writing. I've been writing spec pilots, essentially, that my agent is going out with a new one called World Busters. We're pretty optimistic about it, but, it's a long way from saying that's a sold thing. I've sold pilots before. I've sold them to NBC and to FX, and they didn't produce them, but they paid me.
Yeah, I've heard that's a great racket to get into.
It kind of ends up being one.
That just kind of...
But you always hope that they're, it's going to be more than just
made.
That check, because that's only one check or two. And you want there to be lots of checks.
Checks in perpetuity.
And also you want to see your dream realized, it is exciting if you write something. I wrote some cable television, and it was exciting to see my words turn into, sets and actors and declaiming things. It is exciting. You want to see that happen. I always have some kind of little agenda, like in World Busters is about a couple of guys who are... sort of streety guys based on one of my sons and some of their friends. They at the beginning of it, they're being busted for doing elaborate graffiti somewhere. I mean, they're taggers, in short. And they're kind of like, things have not worked out in their lives for them very well. And then they stumble into this program that is having to do with alternate universes. And they stumble into it and get recruited into it because of a series of circumstances. And they go into this alternative universe where the kind of the right-wing extremism that people like Ford in the 30s, you know.
Right.
You ever see the movie? Henry Speaking Ford. Of Copra, I've got Copra on the brain today, but Meet John Doe was a kind of a warning about how America could become fascist.
Right, yeah.
And this is an alternative universe where it did. Hmm. And so there's a fascist state and a president for life. And, you know, and it's a kind of a post- Patriot Act sort of scenario to some extent that is going on, but our heroes are sort of rebels in that world and then interpenetrating with ours, and it's kind of like my Eclipse books a little bit.
Well, I hope it gets made. As you look at the television now, you actually see a lot more good writing getting produced.
Sure.
Science fiction especially.
Yeah.
More science fiction in general being put out. Yeah.
Yeah, the current version of Battlestar Galactica, I've only caught it a little bit, but it seems so much more sophisticated than the old one, for example. You know,
you can hardly even compare it.
Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, there's no Lou Ayers. You don't remember Lou Ayers?
No.
Very kind of B actor kind of guy.
Battlestar Galactica.
What about,
I have been hearing good things about it, which means that someday I'll break down and watch it.
Yeah, just don't watch the one with the furry robot dog. Because if you see that one, then you know you're watching the wrong one.
That's really? The old one. The furry
Or Lauren Green, you know, that's your other. If it's looking like an Alpo commercial set in the future, then you're probably got the wrong one.
All right, well, I want to thank John Shirley for coming in and joining us today. People should look out for this new book, The Other End.
CemeteryDance.com. And they might want to visit www.signsofwitness.com, which is a website related to The Other End.
Okay, and you also have a blog, which...
JohnShirley.net is my blog.
We will link to on RUSeriousRadio.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?